Welcome to the Limitless Leaders Podcast. This is a show where my guests and I explore and expand on all things mindset, leadership, and communication. On the show, I interview inspiring leaders, business owners, and entrepreneurs from all walks of life, where they share their stories, experiences, and lessons. This is a podcast for you if you're looking to learn, grow, and accelerate your life, career, and who you are. Hi, and welcome to the Limitless Leaders Podcast, where we interview people from all walks of life, including leaders, business owners, entrepreneurs, and maybe even you. Today, I'm super excited to welcome a fantastic guest, someone I've known for a few years, and who I just think is doing inspiring work in the leadership and team space. Michelle Gibbings is a workplace expert, an award-winning author of 3 books, and a global keynote speaker. She's on a mission to help leaders, teams, and organizations create successful workplaces where people can thrive and progress is accelerated. Welcome, Michelle.
Renee, it's so great to be here.
Yes, I feel like I'm talking to an old friend. You're not old, but a friend that I've had for a while. So, no, welcome, welcome. Really excited today to talk to you and also talk about your book, Bad Boss, What to Do If You Work for One, Manage One, or Are One. So I can't wait to delve into this. I read this book. I always read, any guest I have, I always read your book. And I just love the way you've laid it out, the structure, the simplicity. And I think if you're listening out there or watching, you haven't had a bad boss, you will at some stage. Yeah.
Well, and it's also one of those things. Sorry, often say people, it's a book of hope because it's not about finger pointing. It's not about finding the blame. It's saying everyone needs to play their part to have healthy, happy workplaces.
That's right. That's right. And it goes right across. You know, I think you can't sort of pinpoint where that is. And I think it's around just having some strategies to deal with it. I know back in my corporate career, I was lucky enough to have amazing leaders or bosses, but I had one that I call the Kris Kringle, you know, ask for perfume, you get socks. And the biggest gift for me, and I was very aware, was everything he did, I said to myself, I'm going to do the opposite. And it was a really good checklist for me. So I'd love, Michelle, just for our listeners and viewers, sort of where have you come from that's led you to where you are today and, I guess, who you're continually becoming?
So my background is corporate. I had 25-plus years in corporate. That included a stint in politics. I then worked in the mining sector and in financial services. And throughout that time, I crossed functional disciplines. So I did everything from being a company spokesperson, ran strategy functions, large-scale change programs. One day woke up and found myself as head of compliance for a bank. And then the last corporate experience I had was really particularly challenging, and I went on a meditation retreat, and it was at that retreat I really dug into what was it that motivated me, and I realized I love learning, I love being challenged, and that will never stop, that will never go away. But the difference was I was no longer looking for security in terms of security of employment or financial position. I needed autonomy, and really the only way I could do that was to work for myself. And I remember coming home and saying to my husband, we were living in Sydney at the time, and I said to him, I'm done. And he goes, done with what? I said, done with corporate. And he goes, oh, great, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to open a business. And he said, in what? I said, I've got no idea. And that was 10 years ago. And it really was this exploration process in those, you know, really in those first couple of years to get clear on what was the space that I wanted to play in and where did I feel like I could make the most contribution. And, you know, the work that I do has evolved over those 10 years.
Yeah, amazing. And I love that I so resonate with you and what you do. We do similar things but different, obviously. We have different IP and things like that. But the fact I was the same, it was like a light switched on, and I want to grow people not because I'm managing them, but because they want that growth. And, you know, the autonomy side, I think is important too, because as you know, as we know, there's statistics on people opening, going from corporate and opening business. A lot of people don't get through it. How important, I call it your why to fly, your purpose. How important is that for you in the success that you're having and the difference you're making?
It's really important because it's the why that keeps you going. In my second book, which was Career Leap, I talk about, you know, swallow the purpose pill rather than following passion, because yes, passion can mean you flip from thing to thing. Whereas when you're really clear about why it is that you do what you do, it can really ground you and really center you. And that doesn't mean that your why needs to be this massively altruistic thing either. But it, I find for me, my why is about that love of learning. And I see learning and education as an equalizer. It is a thing that can really help shift and develop people and get them to that next step, that next space in their career and also in their life. And so to spend time with people, sharing ideas, helping them generate insights. I mean, and you would know this, it's such a privilege, such a privilege.
It is a, I love that you said that. It is a privilege that people are trusting us in their journey. And I think, you know, and, you know, we know about a growth and a fixed mindset. I call it a bubble or a bursting mindset. But, you know, for those listening, and I get asked this question quite a bit, for leaders that are, have people in their team that just don't want to grow, you know, I'm all I am, I got the role, why should I do more? See it a lot in the older generation. You know, I'm a believer anybody can change. What sort of advice or tips would you give to those people if they're listening? Because if you're actually listening, you've probably got a growth mindset. Just thought of that.
Yeah, it's understand what their drivers are. Yeah. So Edgar Schein's work around career anchors can be really helpful. And if you can understand what is it that helps to anchor the type of career choices that they make, and then help them understand the world of work is changing. You know, it's always changed, but what's different now is just the exponential nature of it. It's changing faster than any of us are predicting. If you don't fall in love with learning, eventually you'll wake up one day and the role that you've got, it will no longer exist. And I always say to people, you can't future-proof your job. Your job will change, but you can future-proof your career. And what sits underneath that is learning. And often what I find with learning is, particularly if you haven't done a lot of learning in recent times, it's that fear, the fear of failure, the fear of not being able to perform. And I always say to people, you know, your brain likes certainty. So when your brain feels a little bit uncomfortable, that's just your brain telling you that you're learning something new. So rather than seeing that as a bad thing, see it as a good thing.
It is, yeah. Yeah, I would say anything outside of I know is growth, right? And it's also too, you know, I think the world is our oyster now when it comes to learning. And if you've got a real learner's mindset, just being careful around what it is. You know, I had someone yesterday go, I don't know what to do next as far as learning. And I said, what do you need? Because a lot of people will gravitate to certain people, you know, even clients to me, but I'm like, I might not be the right person for you. What is it? What is it that you need? And I think actually, you know, we're all leaders of self. How can we progress forward and I guess contribute to others if we're not learning?
Yeah, and part of that starts with that piece around self-awareness, because you can learn stuff, you can learn content, you can learn technical skills, but what are you learning about yourself? And whenever you read the stats, they'll always show that leaders think they are way more self-aware than the data tends to suggest they are. Yeah. And so it's impossible for you to be a successful and an effective leader if you don't spend time understanding yourself. And that doesn't remain stationary. We continue to learn. I mean, I often use myself as an example. And I say, you know, I go look back through COVID lockdowns, and it was a little bit like a Petri dish experiment where I'd sit back and go, wow, that's really interesting. I know myself pretty well, and I'm really interested in how I am currently reacting to what's going on, because I would not have thought that I would have reacted like that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you know, on self-awareness, and like you, we do a lot of work on that and EQ and like all the emotional clearing, that sort of thing. You know, I think the big thing that gets in the way, and I'm guilty of it, I'm no poster child of self-awareness. I'm a doer. I'm always going. I think it's just looking at it as it's not indulgent and having that time to really reflect and reset. I think that's vital.
Yeah, and I think the reflection piece goes hand in hand with self-care. It's really hard to create capacity to do the reflection if you're always in do mode and don't create time to just go, hey, am I okay? Am I exercising enough? Am I getting enough sleep to then have that capacity to be able to think about what's really going around me?
That's right. I say be a human being, not a human doing.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's also self-care versus self-growth. They're interrelated, but you know, I wrote something on this recently. A lot of people confuse them. So I've had some time off and I read your book. I'm like, yeah, that's great. And but it is, it's finding the things you're curious about and the things that just let you breathe. I know for me it's cooking. Cooking's one of my biggest passions outside of work. And, you know, I get people go, how can you be bothered? And I'm like, it's my meditation. I don't watch TV. So finding what that is. Michelle, I'd love to ask you, you know, I'm a big advocate for the gift mindset. And for those that might not know what that is, it's a mindset where we're open to unwrapping the gifts or the lessons in challenging people and situations and positive people and situations. And instead of looking at something that's happened as an event, really reflecting on what it was as an experience to deepen and develop sort of key soft skills. I'd love to ask you, you know, I say it, welcome the unwelcome teaches us the most. Michelle, what would be the biggest gift or lesson to date? There's probably a few, I imagine, for all of us, that has happened to you. What did you make of it? And what have you learnt from that that you're using now in your life and work?
Oh, look, so many things. I do think my final role in corporate was incredibly hard.
Yeah.
And I look back at it and go, if I hadn't gone through that, I don't think I would be where I am now because it provided the impetus to do what I'm doing now.
Yeah.
But also that ability to really sit back and go, who am I? Who do I want to be and where do I want to go? And, you know, because I'd in some respects grown up in a corporate environment, I just assumed that, yeah, that's what I know, that's what I'm good at, that's what I'll keep doing. If I hadn't had that experience, I would never have had the time out to really sit back and go, yeah, actually, what else is there? What could I do? And I mean, I often say to people, you know, if someone said to me 12 months before that sort of exit process happened, would I be working for myself? I don't think I would have said, you know, I probably would have said, oh, no, you know, corporate's my game. I know how to play it. I'm good at it. I'll just keep going. And so, you know, I've learned through that to really work and move through the discomfort. And as you go through that discomfort, you really discover who your friends are, the people who step up when you really need it and really help you. And also a recognition that a love of learning will always see me through, that there are times when I can, you know, be really scared and really nervous and have absolutely feel like I have no idea what I'm doing. But all I have to do is just keep learning and just keep trying and keep moving forward. And it's those incremental steps that make the difference.
Yeah, I love that. And carving out remembering time to think about, you know, where you've come from, what you've been through. I think sometimes, you know, progress is, you know, there's 48 key motivators in a work context. One of them's progress, which most people have. So it's just stopping because we always look at what haven't I done as to what have I done? You know, what have I learnt? Yeah, I love that. I think it's, you know, I always think going through the tough times and, you know, you've been through some, definitely been through a few, especially the last 5 years. You've got to go through them anyway. So it's how you embrace that. And I think use the lessons. And also I'm a big, big believer that our lessons could be a survival guide for someone else. So, you know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
Yeah. So let's talk about your book, Bad Boss. I love it. I love it. And I love the little horns on the A.
Well, it's quite funny. My brother-in-law came up with the title and he wanted to call it Bastard Bosses. He goes, oh, everyone's worked for a bastard. And then the publishers were like, oh, maybe that's a little too extreme. We need to dial it back just a bit.
I love that. I just saw a moving scale then. Bastard, bad, ballistic. I love it. So let's.
I was just going to say, I mean, because the title says bad, but it doesn't mean you're mean and nasty. You can be a bad boss because you're ineffective as well. So yeah, there is definitely a scale.
Yeah, definitely. And I think you could be a great boss, but with a few bad traits, right?
So yeah, absolutely.
Wow. So I'd love to, I wanted just to talk to you first of all. Let you talk about working for a bad boss, managing a bad boss, or you are a bad boss. I'd love to talk about, you know, if you work for one, and I'm sure those listening or watching, we've all been there, and even, you know, you can bring it in the context of a sports coach, a school teacher, that sort of thing as well. So what are some tips if you're working for one? I know in your book you talk about, you know, assessing your position, which I love, strategies and options to move through, acting with intent and reflecting on your progress. And I love you've laid that out for the three areas. Do you want to just run us through working for one? Just a few ways we can assess and maybe, you know, get through that, because it's not easy.
Look, it's not. And when I wrote the book, I was able to write from all three perspectives because I've worked for a bad boss, I've been a bad boss, and I've managed bad bosses. And so I was very open at the front about it because I learned, you know, I absolutely come from the philosophy that leadership is a learned skill. And I was very fortunate, similar to you, to work for some really good bosses who really helped shape my my leadership capability. But when you're working for a bad boss, there's a couple of things, because firstly, you do need to do that deep self-reflection. What is it that you're bringing to the dynamic, and are you actually bringing your best to the table? Because it's really easy to finger point and say you've got a bad boss, but are you actually a bad employee in that you're not delivering on expectations? And so really what the person is doing is trying to performance manage you. So do that self-reflection piece first. Mm-hmm. Then put yourself in the shoes of the boss and understand where they're coming from, because as I was saying before, there is, you know, I've worked for a boss. He was just the loveliest person, so kind, but boy, he was ineffective.
Yeah.
And so he couldn't manage his diary. Everything was always late. And so I shifted how I worked for him. And there were things that I would do working for him that I wouldn't have done for other bosses, because I started to manage the workflow coming into the team. And I remember someone saying, but that's not your role. I said, I know, but if I can manage the workflow, I can then manage how this work is delegated and the impact on me and my ability to be effective. And so it's about understanding the context in which your boss is working. To what extent can you shift how you're behaving to accommodate some of their shortfalls? And often people say, but I shouldn't have to do that. And I'm like, well, you know, do you want the environment to work or not? And so what is it that you can do and shift to make it work? Now, that's very different to an environment where you're working for a narcissist or a bully, who's someone who belittles you, because that's a very different environment. And if you're in that environment, I often say, get really crystal clear. What are you getting out of working for that person? Because I've worked for a narcissist before, and I would not be where I am today if I hadn't worked for them. So it was incredibly powerful in terms of helping my career, but there is an end date, because at a certain point that behavior starts to either erode your self-esteem or it starts to impact how you interact with
not
others.
Sustainable.
Yeah, exactly. And so know when that end point is that you then need to extract yourself to go and work somewhere else. And so that's why having that sort of support network around you is really critical, because when you've had a bad day, you need to be able to go home and talk to people who love you, hug you, and go, you're going to be okay, and you can work your way through this. And so I often say to people, it's the thinking of the long term, not just the short term, whilst protecting yourself from a self-care perspective and also protecting your reputation.
Yeah, fantastic. And I think you've hit the nail on the head. It's really taking action and controlling and managing what you can influence. And I love your mindset around that. Like, you could have just been a victim and gone, this is terrible, and, you know, it affects your health, your life, your career. And a lot of the time I've noticed people that work for a bad boss keep attracting a bad boss. So there's something in there. So I think, you know, I love what you said, just being proactive and looking at what you could help to alleviate that. And that comes from high self-awareness too, yeah?
And it's also the confidence to set boundaries. Yeah. Like, I look back at some of the interactions with that particular individual, and I worked for someone who worked for them, if that makes sense. But this person was the person who I did all the direct work for. They had a very different style to me, because my style would have been, this isn't working. I need to stick up for myself. I need to really set boundaries. They were very much, don't do that. You'll make it worse. Don't set boundaries. And I look at it and go, because I didn't set boundaries, that particular senior person thought I was a doormat. And I look back and go, if I had been me, if I had been who I needed to be in that circumstance, I think the outcomes could have been different. I mean, look, you'll never know the hypothetics of how things can play out. But I often say to people, really challenge how you're being influenced by the people around you as to what is the right way to behave, because different people will say different things. Doesn't mean they're right, doesn't mean they're wrong, but you need to work out what works for you.
Yeah, I love that. I'm big on boundaries, what's okay, what's not okay. I always say to people, even in a new role or, you know, day to day, boundaries are like speed humps. If they're not there, you go out of control and you're not standing for anything. So even, Michelle, I do a lot of work. I've created a little booklet and it's called Your No List. And I've been sharing that with clients for probably a decade now. People look at me and go, everyone says say yes to everything. And I say, well, this is coming from a person that used to say yes to everything. But if you work out in that relationship or in that situation what you won't stand for, so I won't work after 6 o'clock because they pull the work on then that creates the boundary. And I think it's a really good way. People get a bit stuck on boundaries. But what are you saying no to, and articulate that in a sentence? And let people know, so there's that shared accountability as well.
And then hold yourself to it, because people will go, oh, I've got a boundary. And it's like, but hang on, you just stepped over that boundary, which means you've just given a mixed message to everyone else around you that it's okay to bypass that boundary.
Yeah, that's spot on, spot on. Awesome, great, great, great tips there. Easier said than done, I get that, but I think, if you're going to bed at night and dreading work, and, you know, when people say to me, I hate Mondays, I go, do you hate Mondays or do you hate your job? You know, go back a step and go, what can I control? You know, what's my, like you said, my relationship with this or my input into this? What about if you're managing one? So for those leaders out there listening who might be effective, might be great leaders, might not be, but have leaders under them that they're managing. How do you bridge that gap between, you know, not great to being great?
I think the first thing is you've actually got to discover that and really uncover where are their strengths and what's not working. Because sometimes ineffective managers, gee, they're good at managing up. We've all seen situations of that. And so the senior leader goes, but all I get is good reports on this person. They're amazing. And I think, and, you know, and so it's for you as the leader really questioning and going, what's the behavior that's leading to the outcome? And also what are the outcomes that are being delivered? And are you really genuinely assessing just on outcome, or are you actually going, well, behaviors matter? And so getting feedback from people, and, you know, the best way to do that is doing that genuine, open 360 degree feedback process. It's really the only way, but it has to be done through a development lens. It's not done as performance improvement where you're somehow trying to performance manage the person out, because then it's not done with good intent. And I often say to senior leaders, if you're setting a standard, one, are you actually living up to that standard? Because don't hold your direct reports to a standard that you're not prepared to live up to. And then how much effort are you putting into coaching and mentoring the person that is working for you? Because if you've set that standard and you've hired them, put them in the role, or perhaps you've walked into a team and they've been there for some time, be really clear around, do they know what they're accountable for? Do they have that skill set to be able to carry out what they're held accountable for? And what support have they been given to be able to discharge those responsibilities?
That's a big one.
Yeah, because I've seen situations where people are trying to hold someone to account. And I'm going, but hang on, one, you haven't communicated that. And two, you're trying to hold them to account for something they actually can't do. So if you haven't given them the leadership, coaching, and development to be able to get there, that's you hold some responsibility for this. And so you want to be able to have the right development programs that support it. And then you want to be able to see, is this person changing? Are they willing to change? Because you can then make that assessment at the right time.
Yeah.
Am I investing energy, and is it worth the investment because I'm actually seeing some progress?
Yeah, beautiful. Love that. I love, and I love that, you know, it's probably the work we both do is any situation that's not great is manageable. It's just taking that time, like you said, to assess, you know, strategize and then reset around that.
So can I just say one more bit? Because it's also about having the conversations.
Yes.
I remember early in my career, and this is one of the best bosses I ever worked for, and I thought I was a good boss. I thought I was doing everything that was expected of me. And she just said to me, hey, look, Michelle, I get you're ambitious and I get you really focused on the outcomes. And I think she was channeling Maya Angelou when she said this to me. She said, but what really matters is how people feel. Because when they go and do something else, that's the only bit they take with them. And if you can shift how they feel, they will actually work better.
Yeah.
It fundamentally transformed how I led.
Amazing. I love it. I love it. The conversations are important. You know, you and I are both big advocates of regular coaching that's about the coachee, not the manager, you know, going into that. And something for those listening that I've bought into companies probably 8 years now is stay interviews. So we have an actual process. So it's, you know, every quarter, what's making you stay here?
Nice.
What's making you? What don't you like? What do you like? So we avoid the exit interviews. And it's really interesting. I had a client recently do that with his team one-on-one. And this high performer, he wasn't even going to do it with because he just assumed being a high performer, they were happy. And he did the stay interview with them and they were actually looking for another role. They said, you leave me alone so much because I'm good at what I do that I'm not developing. I don't feel supported. And that stay interview saved that person from leaving. So I think it's the conversations, just be human. Bring in those human skills, you know, that intuition to know when and how to have the conversations.
But I also think your example as well is a great example of fairness.
Yeah.
People want to be treated fairly. And if you allocate your time in a way that someone gets more, the other high performers can go, but hang on, what about me? I need to feel like I matter too. I need to feel valued.
That's right. There was a survey done, it's probably 3 years ago now, but, you know, you've got your bottom 10%. You know, so they're your plotters. You've got your 60% that are performing sort of okay, and then you've got your 30% of high performers. And the question was, where should you spend the most time? And my answer was right across, but it's actually the middle 60%, but get the high performers to assist you with that, and then hopefully they move up and the 10% move into that 60, or they, I'd say, free up their future and do something.
Yeah, do something else. Absolutely.
Yeah. What about if there's people listening and they're actually like, I am a bad boss?
Where do they start?
Yeah, where do they start?
Well, I think the fact that they've actually said that to themselves showed that they've made some progress because they've self-identified that they need to do the work. And I think that's usually the hardest part because if you don't have either someone around you who's willing to hold that mirror up to you and challenge you, you can be a bit oblivious to what your impact is.
Yeah.
And so if you're a leader and you are genuinely interested in being a better leader, one, start with the self-awareness, do a 360, talk to your team, really understand them. And often when we think about the team, we think about a collective. And absolutely, the collective comes together and that creates your team culture. But everyone is different. People need different things. And Christine Porath from Georgetown University, you know, all her research has shown the number one thing that really matters to team members, respect.
Yes.
Matters above all else.
Yeah.
And so treat people with respect, be genuinely interested in them and develop them, spend time with them. And if you can do that, a lot of the other elements just fall into place.
Yeah, definitely. And I love that it's respect because a lot say it's trust. I think you have to have respect before you can have trust.
Agree. And look, and there'd be some trust models where respect is an element of trust. But if you think about it, if you don't feel respected, you don't feel valued. If you don't feel valued, you don't feel like you can speak up because you feel like you just don't matter.
That's right. I love that. And it's for yourself as well, self to self, isn't it? If you respect yourself, you're probably going to trust yourself and back yourself. And that comes into that whole self-esteem, self-confidence as well. Yeah.
And setting boundaries, as we were talking about before. If you don't respect yourself, it's very hard to set boundaries.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, there's some great tips there. We could speak all day, I'm sure. And I'd love to ask you, like, who's a leader that you admire and why?
Oh, look, I'm very lucky through my career. And I would say there's a number of people who stand out. And two of them, both of them women, very early in my career. And they were human. You knew they cared about you. They made themselves available. And they were people of their word. They wouldn't say one thing and do another. They wouldn't ever ask you to do something that they wouldn't be prepared to do themselves. And even to this day, you know, I have both of them I haven't probably worked with for about 20, 25 years. I could ring them and both of them would call me back.
I love that. That says it all. That says
it does. And these are both very, very senior women in, you know, still around in the corporate circles today. And they made time for you.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's really a testament to what I call a living legacy. I always say, without disregard, but you know, when everyone dies, they're amazing. Even if you're a criminal, you're amazing. But what about living our legacy now and being that leader that people talk about, even while you're still in a leadership role? I think that says a lot. I love that. You shared a few little sort of quotes and thoughts, and I love this one. Don't get sucked into other people's ideas and agendas. Everyone has an opinion. You need to know what's right for you. Focus on the could do, not the should do. Love that.
Yeah, I often joke to people, look, I love my dad, and obviously my dad loves me, but I often joke that if I'd taken my dad's career advice, I'd be sitting at home unemployed in Brisbane, because there are so many elements of my career where dad would go, oh, you shouldn't do that.
No.
And when you focus on the coulds, it's this sense of opportunity, whereas I find the shoulds can limit us. There's a sense of obligation. This is something that you must do, and it's usually based on someone else's opinion. And that doesn't mean you don't listen to other people, but you really need to know yourself to be able to work out what works for you.
Yeah, definitely. And it's, you know, probably got a lot of corporate escapees out there like you and I. It's that time when you're leaving the safe cocoon of a corporate world. I had so many people go, you'll be back. And my mum even, you know, mum's always been corporate. My dad was big time entrepreneur, and I've always had a sort of hybrid. But I think, no, I always say you've got to have your why to change needs to exceed your why to stay the same.
Yeah, and nice.
Yeah, you're moving forward. Michelle, we talk about limitless leaders, so leaders that learn, unlearn, relearn and evolve and have energy physically, emotionally, mentally, socially and spiritually. That's sort of our thing. Being a limitless leader, we also need to have balance in our lives. Yeah. I'd love to ask, what do you do and focus on to keep yourself re-energized?
I'm a structure girl. I find when I have structure in my life, I manage to get things done. And I remember once having a conversation with my husband saying, you need to be more spontaneous. And Craig goes, Michelle, I can't build spontaneity into the structure of your day.
That's so funny. I love that. That could be a meme.
But I know it sounds a little bit naff, but I do meditate every morning. Meditation has really changed my life. It's very grounding. I meditate, I reflect at the end of each day. I do a gratitude journaling process. I do a lot of exercise. A bit like you, I cook. I find the cooking really relaxing, and I'm vegetarian, so there's always something that I'm experimenting with. Mm. And where we live, there's a lake down the road, and I just every day we go down the lake, we walk around the lake. I count the swans at the moment to see how many baby swans have survived this season. Yeah. And it's just beautiful. And then playing with the dog. I mean, I often say to people, I love my life.
Have I had the dog before?
You did. Apologies, Barney.
I was thinking we've got a cat now. We always only had dogs. We've adopted this stray cat, and he's 20, and I just love him. And I'm thinking, he doesn't make that noise.
No. That is Barney just going, hello, I am here. But look, I often say to people, I have a relatively simple life. But it's very deliberately constructed. And one of the quotes or questions that Craig and I always ask ourselves is, if we do this, will it overly complicate our life? And if the answer to that is yes, then we don't do it, because I see people who chasing something, and it could be comparison or because someone else has done something, and then they end up in this really complicated situation. And I just go, oh, I have no interest in being there. That's not what I want. It doesn't mean I don't want to be challenged and I don't want to grow, but I do not need additional complexity in my life.
I love that question, because I think sometimes we get on this trajectory, and we've all been there, where you're just going to achieve something, and it's you just keep doing it because you've got to, and you're not changing trajectory, or you're not going, is my why still as strong as it was at the start?
Yep.
I think that's a great question, you know, being it's the new year, to ask yourself, you know, what's your big word for the year? Is it simplify? Is it consolidate? What, you know, will this complicate my life? And I love that. It's so simple, but questions are just so, you know, as you know, so powerful, which is amazing. So I have got some trivia that we always
Okay.
What is your favorite word?
Oh, that is so hard. I almost feel like I can't answer it, because I'm a words girl, not a numbers girl. At the moment, I'm doing a PhD and I decided to do quant. And I do not know why I decided to do quant, because I really, you know, I get excited if I can make an Excel spreadsheet sum. But I think to me, words, as you say before, words are really, really powerful. And so choose your words deliberately and be really mindful of the impact that those words have. And what I've really noticed, particularly in the last 10 years, the meaning of words have changed. And so you need to really stay across the currency of words. And so, you know, if I had to pick one word, it'd be learning, because I just, you know, I love learning. It underpins everything that I do.
Yeah. And I asked this question because I get some, a guest I had recently was kumquat.
Oh, wow.
Like, all right. And I've always loved the word languishing. It's like
nice.
It's something.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting. I love it. And I think, yeah, there are so many words out there. I mean, I'm very guilty of, I think I've got 9 words I've made up and trademarked now. I've got one, posimistic. I was being interviewed on the gift of optimism, which is one of the 12 gifts of a gift mindset. And I was thinking of positivity and optimism at the same time. And I said, I just unconsciously said, you just got to be posimistic. And I kept talking and the guy's like, Renee, what's posimistic? And I'm like, I didn't say that. He goes, yeah, you did. I said, well, it's a possibility of being optimistic.
Oh, nice. I like that.
That's a bit of laugh. What sound or noise do you love?
What sound or noise do I love? I am absolutely a music for the mood that you are in. So depending on how I'm feeling, if I'm energized, I'm dancing around the room to Dua Lipa. But at the same time, if I'm trying to study or I need music that is calming, there's a beautiful playlist on Spotify called Peaceful Piano, which I listen to. And then there is another piece that I listen to all the time, Ludovici Einaudi, and I probably pronounce that really badly, but his music is just beautiful.
Oh, gorgeous. I love that. Yeah, music can so... I'm the same. I forget about it sometimes. The days I used to have it blaring on a Saturday morning when I was cleaning the house. And I think now with Spotify and everything too, you can really, there's so much you can get. So it's your last day on earth, and it isn't, but if it was, what would be your last meal that you would have?
Naan bread. I know that sounds really weird. I have it. My husband is Indian, but I had a love of naan bread before I met Craig. And I still remember when I was living in Sydney in my 20s and there was a little Indian home diner around the corner, and I'd walk in and they'd look at me really strangely and go, just naan bread? And I'd go, yeah, just, they go, you sure you don't want a curry? And I said, no, just naan bread. So look, I think I'd probably expand the repertoire and maybe have it with a curry as well. But I love naan bread, but it's got to be fluffy. It's got to be fluffy.
It's got to be the good homemade. Yeah.
And it's got to be kind of like a fluffiness and a density to it at the same time.
Yum, yum. And what profession other than your own would you attempt if you could?
I think I'd love to be an interior designer.
Mm.
I love colour and fabrics and architecture and the sort of, the aesthetics of having things in a place.
Yeah, beautiful. Did you want to do that as a child? Was that something that sparked?
No, when I was in grade three, I wanted to be a member of Charlie's Angels. And then I wanted to be a teacher. And then I think I wanted to be a photographer, a photographer, sorry, with National Geographic. So it just kept evolving.
Isn't it interesting if you put all those things, and this is something everyone should do this, and this happened by default. Someone asked me what I wanted to be growing up. So always wanted to be a teacher. Then I wanted to be a nun when I broke up with my boyfriend for 2 weeks. That was only a 2 week thing. Then I wanted to be a nurse. I was a professional dancer growing up, so I wanted to be a performer. And then I actually had this epiphany, and I'm like, I do all that now. I speak, I write books like you do. So that's sort of the journalist part, and teaching. So it's a really interesting little exercise to do.
If I did that, I'm not quite sure where Charlie's Angels would fit in, but I'm sure I could give it a crack.
We'll have to do a podcast with three of us. No. Oh, Michelle, I've absolutely adored having you. Just so natural, so generous with all your insights. If there were just one tip for everyone out there listening right now, in regards to, being a good, effective boss or managing a person that may not be, what would that be?
There is no one size fits all, and leadership is contextual. And so understand the context in which you work, but to be a good leader, you have to genuinely want to be a good leader, and you have to like people. So if you don't like people, find the technical track that you can go down to be successful in your field. Because I so often see people who go, I have to lead people, that's the only way I can get promoted. And it's like, but you
It's a
don't want to. Well, yeah. And but I also think it's the way organizations structure how they
mindset.
work, as opposed to going, there is a promotion track that is technical and a promotion track that is people focused, and we need both.
I agree. I totally agree with that. I've had leaders that are good at what they do. And I say, because my saying is what lights you up? And I go, but what are you good at that you enjoy? Oh, I'm good with people. Yeah, but what do you enjoy? Oh, I can't stand actually working with people, but it's the way to get to the top. So I agree, organizations need to have more of that conversation around having a succession pathway, whether you're technically and people brilliant, or you would just want to focus on the people. Michelle, where can people get your book, Bad Boss, and how can they find you?
Thank you for asking. The easiest is to go to my website, which is michellegibbings.com, and then the book, you can buy it on my website or Booktopia, Amazon, all the usual outlets.
Awesome. And they can find you and your services on the same website?
Yes, they can. And LinkedIn and Instagram and all of those beautiful social
Oh,
sites too.
perfect. We'll list all your links and everything in the show notes, Michelle. Thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. And for those of you listening to this, we're into the new year. Keep an eye out on our public programs. We've got an emotional intelligence to lead masterclass coming up in April. And we've got some Limitless Leaders planning days where you can come along for the day, mix with like and unlike-minded leaders, set goals, set boundaries, set your no list, and really tap into your well-being for you. So thanks again, Michelle. Wherever you're tuning in from or watching from, stay safe, stay well, and we'll see you soon. Thank you for listening to the Limitless Leaders podcast. So you don't miss an episode, make sure you follow the show in your favorite podcast app. Feel free to share this podcast with your family, friends, and work colleagues. If you're enjoying the show, find out more on what we do at RG Dynamics at www.renejerusso.com. Until next time, be limitless.